and welcome to Need to Know, your weekly investment podcast brought to you by the experts at Coutts. I'm Sarah Muir. I'm delighted to be joined by, in the offices here in Coutts' main office in 440 Strand, by our own CIO, Alan Higgins. Morning, Alan. I should say, well, we're just about morning still.
Still morning, Sarah.
And now each week on the podcast, for those of you who are new to Need to Know, we look at the three things investors need to know for the week ahead. But before we get to that, Alan, I just want to touch base with you because it is Jackson Hole starting this week. Now, we're not going to talk about that this week, but sort of expectations. I mean, this is the big gathering of all the sort of world central bankers, isn't it? Any expectations of what we might get anything interesting out of Jackson Hole?
You know, more important than that, you know what I'm really missing out on not being there?
Oh, well, the fishing.
Yes, the fly fishing is amazing. And what they actually do, they carve out an afternoon. And I believe it was Alan Greenspan that started it because he loves his fly fishing.
Yeah. Well, isn't that how they got him to go to
Place? They said, look, we'll do it in Jackson Hole. Yeah. So he loves. So they carve out an afternoon of fly fishing. So we shall see. I think Jerome Powell is speaking Friday afternoon. We'll cover it next week. I mean, sometimes they can be quite significant in terms of the direction of monetary policy. But other times, you know, it's all about the fishing. So we will come back on that.
I believe the title for this year's symposium, whatever it's called, is Structural Shifts in the Global Economy. So we'll report back on that in our next Need to Know. All right, then. So what are the three things we need to know this week?
So I think we will come back to kind of alternatives to equities or rivals to equities.
Yeah.
We've covered luxury bags. Yeah. We've covered watches, albeit very briefly. We may well get an expert on in these categories. And stuff.
Yes.
So we'll come back to that. So I thought with Michael Burry from The Big Short being in the news.
Everywhere.
Where have you seen it?
I've seen it in the Daily Mail. I've seen it in the Times. Interestingly, less in the Financial Times, but it seems to be a big story for the mainstream media.
Yeah, that's right. And he is the hedge fund manager played by Christian Bale. And you've seen the film. Do you like the film?
I have seen it. Funnily enough, in advance of us doing the podcast, I actually watched it again over the weekend. And I was surprised by how good it was. It's very entertaining. I don't know how good as a piece of educational film it is, but it's definitely very, very entertaining. And Christian Bale is brilliant.
He is brilliant.
As Michael Burry.
Also, he was in American Psycho, another city film. Slightly different story.
Yeah, slightly different vibe. Let's not dwell on that because this is a podcast for general consumption.
It's true, but there was some great music in American Psycho. Great 1980s cheesy music. But anyway, so we'll cover Michael Burry. But before that, a bit of an educational piece because we have quite a lot of sophisticated listeners in the investment world who know this, but some who may want to learn more. So let's cover shorting in general.
Yes.
What it means to be short. How do you get short as number one?
Yeah.
So a bit of an educational piece.
Yeah.
Then link into, okay, what is Michael Burry? What is Michael Burry's positions today?
Yeah.
And, you know, what do they mean? What's his track record like? And then finally, I thought we'd kind of pivot semi to China. There's this BRICS conference in South Africa.
Yes.
What's going on there?
Yeah.
And an update on kind of the view on China, which is very, very difficult.
Yeah. There's some challenging headlines coming out at the moment. Okay, well, let's start off then. So before we get to talking about Michael Burry and his latest big short, what is short selling for those that don't know, and particularly what Michael Burry's doing, which is he's taken out put options, hasn't he? So perhaps let's go back to basics.
Yeah. So we'll come back to put options. So most people come to investing from buying stuff, buying shares, buying bonds, buying gold. But it is quite possible to have zero investments and to be so-called short the market.
Right.
And there are futures markets. So I'll use very simply the S&P 500, roughly the 500, because it's not always 500, roughly the 500 biggest US stocks. They are basically in the index at the correct market weight, with Apple the biggest, down to the smallest, down at number 500 or so. There's a very liquid futures exchange, which means you get the S&P 500 3 months forward, typically.
Okay.
I'm looking right now, for example, at the December contract. So from an investor point of view, if you think about it, there's two trades you could do, if you like.
Yeah.
Actually, there's three trades you could do. If you wanted broad exposure, this is not about active management, you could buy all 500 stocks yourself.
Yes.
In the S&P 500. A lot of work, but computers.
Expensive.
And computers do that. Yeah, it's expensive, but computers make that a bit easier. Or you can buy an index fund or an ETF, which we covered before, and it's all wrapped into one fund. Or you could actually buy the future. So for $1 million, okay, so obviously buying the stocks, buying the fund, $1 million, it's invested. The interesting thing about the future, for $1 million, you only have to put up, I'll estimate here, probably $25,000-$30,000. It's kind of margin. So you have $970,000. I'm aware I'm not talking about shorting at all yet, but it's important to understand futures. So you'll have $970,000. And the way that works is that you get a return on that cash. And that return on that cash plus your futures should equal the S&P 500. In a straightforward way. Now you can turn that around and say, well, instead of buying it, I'm going to sell it. I'm going to sell it. Same thing, I'm going to sell $1 million worth. Okay. Again, I put up 15, 20, $25,000, so kind of initial margin. And if the market goes down, I prosper from that. But it's worth going back to, okay, there's futures markets, but kind of how do, if we work for Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley, how would we actually hedge that? How would we actually work with that? Now, the futures market's very liquid and it has its own liquidity, but I really like going back to first principles. And basically, how it works is this in very simplistic terms. If you and I are short $1 million worth of the S&P 500 contracts via Goldman Sachs, in very simplistic terms, they want to hedge themselves. They will also go short. They will sell all 500 stocks. Now, of course, there's liquid futures market, they don't. How do they do that? They borrow them. Because they don't own them, because there's a short bit, and there's a borrowing market to do it. So
So essentially then, just so if I say let's say a given stock is worth $100 at the moment, but I think the value of that stock is going to go down over the next couple of weeks or the next few months. Let's say I think it's going to go down to $75 or $50, but you think it's going to stay at $100 or possibly go up. I can offer to sell you that stock at that price of $100,
Yeah.
but I'm not going to deliver that stock to you until the price has gone down. I'm able to buy it at a lower price, and then I basically pocket the difference. Is that in simple
In
terms what
simple
it
terms,
is?
you're just missing a few tricks because we want to get this precise for education. For is this, and we'll use the example of Tesla because actually, Tesla features with Michael Burry a little bit later. Is that if you want to short sell Tesla stock because you believe it's you no longer believe in Elon Musk and you believe it's ridiculously overpriced. If you wanted to do that, what you need to do is borrow the stock immediately because you're selling the stock to Goldman Sachs. So the trade works like this. I want to sell $1 million worth of Tesla. I don't own them. And obviously, you have to have the right kind of account set up. Goldman Sachs says, fine, okay, you need to borrow them. Have you got your borrower arranged? You borrow them typically from a pension fund or insurance company for a fee. It's a fee you borrow. The pension fund or insurance company, if you're like a long-term holder of Tesla or the likes of BlackRock or the index, lend you the Tesla stock. You deliver that Tesla stock to Goldman Sachs. Okay, it has to be delivered.
Got
So, I mean, it is possible to structure trades 3 months forward,
it.
but you are taking it to advance. But the way to think about it is that there is definitively a borrow. And that became important with our friends. Do you remember the GameStop mania?
I do, yes, because that was all the buzz, wasn't it? Right at the start of the pandemic when we all went into lockdown. And I think predictions were that GameStop was going to struggle during the pandemic because they were going to have the lack of footfall. But actually, Michael Burry, who we're going to be coming to in a moment, actually identified that probably it was going to be quite good for companies like GameStop.
And other hedge funds that were on the other side. So they had short sold GameStop. They saw it as a busted company. They'd borrow the shares. And this is what became interesting. When all the fans, the Reddit fans, bought that stock, they also didn't lend it out. So it became very, very expensive to borrow. So it was a double whammy, very expensive to borrow, because there's a cost to borrow, one, and two, the price was shooting up. So Michael Burry may well have profited. Actually, I've missed that story amongst the Michael Burry news, but we'll come to Michael Burry later. But obviously, there were some famous hedge funds, and there's about to be. I think there's a film because I was at the cinema the other day, it might have even been Barbie, I don't know. But I was in the cinema the other day and they were featuring, there's a film coming out about the whole GameStop and Reddit situation. So we'll obviously have to report on that.
Definitely.
So that's selling short, right. But that's not what Michael Burry did.
But essentially what you're doing is you're doing the opposite of what you would normally do when you buy a stock. Your expectation is that the price will go down, not that the price will go up.
Correct.
And you're betting on that, aren't
yeah.
you? Okay, so then what is it that Michael Burry has done? And we'll come to his particular thing, his current situation, a little bit later. But if we go back to The Big Short.
Well, we'll come to put options. Yeah, we'll cover put options.
What is a put option?
So it's a way of it's a way of being short or hedging. Some people call it hedging. But again, with $1 million with no investment, it's quite possible with the right agreements to buy just put options, which is effectively another bet on the market falling. This is the difference, is that you pay a premium for it, okay? And whereas when you sell short, you are short the market.
Right.
In the full amount. Whereas when you buy an option, it's like an option in English.
Okay.
You have the right to be short at a price.
But it can expire, can't it?
And it expires. So to give you an example, okay, end December, the S&P 500, I'll use very round numbers, 4,500, circa 4,500. If you want to buy a put option to protect you to the, to be short, let's not talk about protection because we're talking about shorting. To think, you just want to be short the market and you don't want to be in the first category, outright short the market.
Yeah.
You think that's too risky. You'd rather have this put option. Well, you can be short at 4,500, where it is today, till the end of December, it'll cost you about close to 3.5%.
Okay.
So what does that mean? It means, in simple terms, if the market falls more than 3.5%, you start to make money.
Yes.
Okay. If the market only falls 2-3%, you don't make any money.
Yeah.
Whereas in our previous example, when you short sold, if the market falls 3%, you make that 3% money.
Yes.
So a put option is, firstly, it's a more risk averse way of being bearish on the market. I'm not going to say short the market, one. But two, you can see you can do it in leverage form. And we'll get back to Michael Burry in a moment.
Because the downside to short selling and owning the stock is that your losses are unlimited, aren't they?
Yeah, we've seen that with Tesla. GameStop. We've seen the GameStop and the film that's about to come out. People had huge multiples of losses. Was when you buy a put option, that's it.
You just let it expire. You've lost your premium.
But you can see it's reasonably chunky. And then we may have to come back to this, but I do think it's worth understanding. We now work for Goldman Sachs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Michael Burry's bought this put option at the money at 3.3%.
Yeah.
How do we hedge ourselves?
Yeah.
On the S&P 500, how do we hedge ourselves?
How
do we cover ourselves? Because we can't, so there's a market in options to cover.
Yeah.
But fundamentally, the interesting point, do you know what Goldman Sachs will immediately do for an at-the-money option? They'll immediately sell 50% of the stocks. So if it's $1 million, they'll sell $500,000 worth of those 500 companies. It's called delta hedging.
Okay.
We want to leave some advanced stuff.
Oh, crikey. Let's leave that for another.
Because it's an option, because the intuition is this, okay? The intuition is this, is that if the market crashes 20%, okay, that option's worth an awful lot, okay?
Right.
And therefore, Goldman Sachs, we're picking on Goldman Sachs, has to dynamically manage that exposure by selling more and more stock as it goes down. But the first thing they do for when it's at the money is roughly sell half.
Okay.
So it's what I wanted to get across there. It's still effectively short the market it's a bearish position from Goldman Sachs, and at the money is about half.
Okay.
So that's a bit of theory.
Okay. All
Good
right.
news, everyone. The theory is over. That was hard work, wasn't it?
How's
your brain?
No, my brain's fine. At the moment, my brain's fine. But I just wanted to ask you one more question. So that's when we hear when somebody's shorted or when a stock has been shorted, like we saw with GameStop. That's when the price of that stock goes up, that's when you get a short squeeze, isn't it?
Correct.
That's when everybody is
there. They call it a short squeeze. And that's exactly what happened.
Trying to buy
yeah.
stock
yeah.
to fulfill those
yeah.
to before
yeah.
the price goes up even
yeah.
more.
Yeah.
And actually, funny enough, I was looking at this. The biggest short squeeze. Do you know what the biggest short squeeze in history was? I'm going to put you on the spot now.
Thank you. It's about time you did this to me. So GameStop must be close, but Tesla must be up there. But go on. Well, put me out of my misery.
If my research this morning is correct, it was actually 2008. It was Porsche.
Oh, yes, I remember that. Porsche back, Volkswagen. That was horrible.
Back in 2008, they increased their stake in Volkswagen to around about 75%.
Yeah.
The state of Lower Saxony, where I used to live, already held around about 20%, which left very few shares available to trade. And as the share price rose, short sellers were forced to buy back their shares. And in fact, the VW share price went up to 999 euros.
I did. So it was the biggest in terms of financial damage. Crucified. Yeah, so you're quite right. So the film on GameStop is called Dumb Money.
Okay.
It's got Seth Rogen in it and some people I don't really know. I'll just read it. Set during the GameStop short squeeze events from Jan 21. We'll both go and watch it, right?
Definitely.
Not necessarily together, and we'll report back.
Yeah, absolutely. When is that out?
Oh, you got me there. I've just put the phone down. It's soon.
Okay.
It's soon.
Okay. Well, that's one to watch.
It doesn't say.
It may or may not be making some film.
I'll definitely go and watch that. Okay. That's it. Yeah.
Well, let's come then to the reason why we went through that quite sort of lengthy explanation of short selling is Michael Burry, famous as the man who predicted the mortgage crisis in America, has come out with another big short. What's he done?
So he's done it the put option way. So it needs to be set in context, is that from what I can see, he manages about 250 million from you doing a bit of digging online. That may or may not be right, but that's what's online. And he, because he runs a hedge fund, he has to disclose his put options. Okay. But this is it. It's not just, he's just given the size, which look huge.
Yeah.
I think 1.6 billion.
Yeah.
But those are nominal. But it's certainly a big bearish position. But look, let me give you a flavour. On the S&P 500, for example, why is he doing it? So I mentioned that it currently costs 3.3% to be bearish at current levels to end December. Okay. That doesn't seem like too much, does it? Mm-hmm. Markets move a lot.
Yeah.
Okay, that's because volatility is low.
Okay.
So what drives the price of these options is volatility. Okay. So when volatility is low, the main thing that drives the price.
Hmm.
So the greater
the volatility, the more expensive.
Yeah, so I'm going to give an example. So when volatility right now about 15%, it costs about 3.3%. At volatility at 40%, so a more volatile time, that option will cost you 8.8%.
Because the expectation is that there's a greater chance of
built into a price.
Premium increases.
So part of his thinking, which I think is smart, is wow, volatility is low right now. Mm-hmm. It's really cheap there's some cheap options available. Furthermore, how else can you make these options really cheap? You can put them so-called out of the money. A phrase, what does that mean? Very simple. So the S&P 500 is 4,500. Let's say you're really bearish and think it's going to fall below 4,000, which is kind of the trade he did in the big short in the mortgage market, out of the money. So let's say, if you think the market's going to fall 20%, then that's fine because it's going to fall below 4,000.
Yeah.
So to give you a flavour, an end December put option today at 4,000 only costs
0.3%. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's actually relatively
Little. Relatively little. So that's how we really don't know exactly what positions he has. So a bit of speculation here. Mm. But I can see that he can certainly afford $1 billion of notional, if you like, exposure to the market. If you go out of the money, which is his style, he has form here at 0.3%.
Is it fair to say then, because obviously I mentioned right at the beginning that, funnily enough, I've seen very little about this in the FT, but I have seen a lot about it in the mainstream media. Are they perhaps getting a little bit carried away with this? Do they think this is a bigger bet than perhaps it is, in fact?
To a certain extent, because the numbers, I think 1.6 billion scares people. But look, to spend this much money on option premium, you know, that if nothing happens and markets don't fall, that money's gone forever.
Yes.
So you have to respect, he's obviously he's an investing genius. He's a great track record. Not many people saw OJ9.
Mm-hmm.
He has a tremendous reputation as actually a value investor, buying very cheap discounted stocks. His record, though, and I've got it here, of making these big sort of market macro calls. And look, we have to be humble. I don't hold anything to him, in comparison. But I'll just read through a couple. For example, May 17, he predicted a global financial meltdown. 1 year later, the S&P 500 up just under 20%. This was an interesting one. I remember this one. September 19, he really hated index ETFs, and they'd become bigger and bigger. I'm not so sure he's got a point, but I'd love to debate it with him, super intellect.
Is it fair to say
if he's listening, should we get him on?
Yeah, definitely. If you're listening, Michael Burry, we'd love to have you on.
Bearish bias,
He's a bearish investor, isn't he?
A bearish investor, but willing to take a lot of value investors. So you mentioned GameStop, which actually I didn't know about it. So the S&P 500 rose. And then more recently, Feb 21, shorted Tesla, amongst others, and allegedly was short. Michael, sorry if you're listening, I will tag you on the internet. The market was up 16% over the next 12 months. So look, all I would say is, you're absolutely humble because from my perspective, he is actually a genius investor, which goes to show how hard it is, even for genius investors, to get these things right.
Yeah.
And, I met several times the other big name in The Big Short.
Yes.
Steve Carell character. Yeah. So his guy called real name Steve Eisman. I know he wasn't called that in the film. Why? Because he worked for a firm called Front Point, and I was working at Morgan Stanley at the time, and we were basically promoting his fund. And intense character. Again, another genius. A lot of these geniuses are intense. Obviously, I'm not intense enough. But hey, I know where I stand. But him as well, look. He started a fund in 2012, briefly afterwards. Couldn't get it to work, which is fine. Look, I briefly did manage a hedge fund. I couldn't get it to work either for a couple of years. And I'm nowhere near in their league. But Common was shorting Tesla. Elon Musk has got a lot to answer for, don't you think?
Yeah.
Taking out these genius investors.
I know. But I guess what I want to come back to Michael Burry is that he hasn't shorted everything, has he? Because the headline number is that he's shorting America's stock market. But he is actually, did I read correctly that he's actually long energy, travel and media companies, isn't he?
Yeah, so he will be long in his standard portfolio, a bit like The Big Short, because you may remember in The Big Short, some angry executives run in and say, what are you doing? Stick to value investing. Yeah. Stop doing this stuff. And so he carries on doing that deep value. And he's had a go at buying China. He's out of that because China is cheap, and we'll come on to China.
Yeah.
He's had a go and think and looking at some of these Chinese, but I think he's been long in the last year or so, Alibaba and the likes, because these need to be disclosed, by the way.
Yes.
SEC filings. That's why we know this apart from the press. So that's his style. So he will have some value stocks, but I think it's fair to say then they're quite special situations, not particularly correlated.
Okay.
I think it is a bearish bet. It needs to be respected.
Yes.
The final point I would make for people who are alarmed, I've been doing this 35 years. I'm not in their league as investors, obviously, but big, big declines in markets are rare.
Yeah.
I've seen 4 over 35% in 35 years. Starting with the 87 crash when I started my career. So they're just rare.
Yeah.
So
I mean, 10% correction
could be enough for him.
Not unusual.
Well, as we know, 10% correction, nearly, it's rare not to have a 10% correction.
Yeah.
So maybe he gets a 10% correction and that he will look,
he'll make money on his puts.
Yeah, there's something, even if his puts are out of the money, if you like 10% out of the money, 10% lower than this. If the market starts to correct, your options go up. They become more valuable.
Yeah.
We can always do a learner. If it's popular, these learners, we'll do more of them.
Yeah. Okay. So in short, pardon the pun, Michael Burry sort of came to prominence for a wider audience because of his bet against the US housing market back just before the global financial crisis. He's come out again with a big bet against the S&P and the NASDAQ. But what we don't know exactly is how much of skin in the game he's got. He's taken out put options. He's anticipating that the S&P and the NASDAQ will go down. He feels they're overvalued. Let's wait and see how that plays out. But it's not necessarily, he might not be right. And if he might be right, but not as it might not be as bad as perhaps he thinks it's going to be. All right, then. So that's Michael Burry. Let's turn then to our final point, which is we talked about China there and the fact that actually Michael Burry has got thoughts on China, but China and then roll that into BRICS, because we've got a big meeting this week, haven't we, in South Africa.
Yeah, so China seems to be setting the agenda for this, for an enlargement of BRICS to rival G7. I would say, honestly, is that the best use of time? I mean, G7 is super useful in a crisis.
Yes.
But really, was there much, you know, coordination or discussion on inflation to help us out?
None at all.
You know, when I was ranting and raving about when rates were zero, virtually everywhere in the G7 or even negative in the Eurozone. So I get it. But fundamentally, when it comes to China, you know, firstly, we talked about humility. This great quote. So our friends at GavCal found this quote from Thomas Sowell on economics. I'll read it out because I love a good quote. And I think this is absolutely true about investing, but especially when it comes to China. It takes considerable knowledge just to realize the extent of your own ignorance. And then it goes on to talk about China in this spirit. China, it's hard enough focusing on the US and the UK and the likes of China. So China, the property bust.
Yes.
So the ignorance there on our part, who knows how bad it is.
Yeah.
We read about it, Country Garden, has defaulted, may go full-time bust. They've got some time to make some interest, doubt if it's going to work. Mm. We shall see. Who knows how that's going to end? Could it be at the bottom? Ignorance comes in there. But what I do know about is corporate governance and being a minority shareholder. And the crackdown on corporations in China makes it very difficult, because we covered... when we covered luxury goods, we covered LVMH versus Rolex watches.
Yeah.
And over the long run, over 10 years, LVMH was up
800%.
Yeah. Great being a minority shareholder there. Why? The truth is out. Mm. As a minority shareholder, it doesn't matter. You have no control, but strong growth in profits, basically, ironically, a lot from China and Asia. Yeah. Relatively unconstrained, good corporate governance, and therefore you benefit. Unfortunately, the crackdown on companies and general crackdown on corporate governance. Now, China bulls will tell me there are signs this is changing.
Okay.
And I hope they're right. Mm. And I love to be a contrarian. You know me. I would love to be. The Chinese stock market, the A shares, are down 50% from their highs, give or take.
Okay.
So I would love to say buy, and everyone's so pessimistic. But I can't bring myself, look, we're overdue a bounce. So I'm saying nothing about the real short run.
Yeah.
I can't bring myself until I see real protection, or just let companies basically prosper in the right way. Of course, there's controls over companies in the United States, UK, Europe, as rightly there should be. But the big crackdowns we've had on the mega tech of China, that's a big problem for me. So. Mm. I would say, do not, so what? So they expand the BRICS, Saudi Arabia gets involved, and good talking shop, but it's all about corporations. And of course, China has a big youth unemployment issue.
Yeah.
What solves youth unemployment? Great companies doing well, employing people. Mm-hmm. Who funds these companies? Well, can be private shareholders, or shareholders. It sounds very capitalist. I know it's terrible. I'm sorry, but it's the way the world works. Yeah. So I think we'll stop there, because we've had a long one. It's always longer when we're together.
It is. Okay. So in summary there, we've got BRICS meeting this week. We've got China has been calling for sort of more members to join BRICS to give it a little bit more clout. I mean, I did check up something like 40% of the world's population sits within a BRICS company, and they account for 25% of the global economy. But as Alan points out, the Chinese economy needs to allow corporations to function as corporations so that shareholders can benefit and those companies can grow and the economy can grow, because obviously we're getting some concerns about the Chinese economy at the moment. That's all for this week. A reminder that the views expressed in this podcast are not intended to constitute investment advice, are accurate at the time of recording, and are subject to change. Thank you very much, Alan, for joining me today. I say apologies if you've heard any sort of teacups or glasses clanking. We are recording this together face to face, which is always very nice when we're able to do that in our offices in 440 Strand. Don't forget to check out the podcast page on Coutts.com. And of course, you can subscribe to the podcast via Apple, Spotify, or wherever you access your podcasts. You can listen to previous episodes, including last week's when we talked about the performance of a Rolex Daytona versus stock in luxury companies. So you have to listen to last week if you want to know which one is the better investment or has been the better investment in the past. Anyway, we'll be back with next week with more Need to Know. And I'm sure we'll have updates from Jackson Hole. But until then, bye for now.